This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Decade Project. This is a one heat minute production Patreon preliminarily exclusive podcast where we're looking in our rear view 10 years ago at the movies that are still hanging around, the big movies of the year, the small movies, the things that are ripe for rediscovery, or something that is downright unloved. And that is why I have the man himself. It is Scout DeFoya. Scout, thank you so much for coming back to talk to me. It feels like it's so soon. People are going to listen to this a little bit after our Anthony Mann episode on the Patreon if they're a supporter, or way later in the year. So you can hear Scout on lots of shows that we do. But we are here to talk about a movie that really, like, I saw long before Scout and I were friends. I watched his amazing video essay series on RodrigoBear.com. I was consuming this and I watched it and I was like, this is such a beautiful poem and dedication to a movie that is very misunderstood, but also feels like, in the strangest way, the most relatable experience if you ever have felt out of place. It's like an entire movie that you feel out of place, and that doesn't just extend to the crazy, chaotic Hollywood lifestyle. It's feeling out of place in a relationship, which is also probably one of the most deeply relatable things, I think, for everyone. This is from, in his absolute sicko mode run, Terrence Malick's Knight of Cups. Listen to this ethereal trailer, and we'll come back and we'll talk about this movie.
Years living the life of someone I didn't even know.
Let me tell you about you. I want to make you rich.
You see the palm trees? They tell you anything's possible.
No one cares about reality anymore.
Different these days. What's going on with you?
Me with leaving, okay? Do what you want to do.
You don't want love. You want a love experience.
There are life flavors. Sometimes you want raspberry, then after a while you want some strawberry.
You have love in you. I know it.
Blind. Suppose it isn't there for me.
I was afraid when I was young. Afraid of life. Who pays for it?
Once the soul was perfect and had wings and could soar into heaven.
You gave me peace.
My friend, Welcome back. Great to see you. Thanks for coming on to the Decade Project. As we talk about in all of these shows, what was the preliminary reception? And in this one, the thing that you forget, if you just are thinking about the movies, if you're not familiar as you and I are with like the sequence of different filmmakers, you forget that like Tree of Life is the movie that precedes Knight of Cups, which was such a huge by Malick comparisons movie, both critically, culturally. It had such a splash.
It was huge. It's difficult to remember that a movie, you know, it's the thing that I expected to happen when Megalopolis came out.
Yes, yes.
Where, you know, this auteurist object rears its head after, you know, threatening to for many years. And it gets every little detail right. You know, Tree of Life, one of the truest films about childhood. I remember seeing it with my dad and him just sort of afterwards stunned almost to silence, basically being like, that was my childhood. Like he recognized every little, you know, the anger in the dad and the, you know, the things that you do to entertain yourself when you didn't have television. You know, it was just like, it was the most relatable experience there. And he really loved pulling it apart and figuring it out. And at one point we were having a conversation about like, you know, that whole movie being the thought that Sean Penn has on his way down the elevator.
Yes.
Like he just sort of takes in the entirety of existence to be like, why do I feel this way? You know, I'm hearing this bad news and I'm like, why do I feel so pained? And it's like, oh, because of all of this. And, you know, like just trying to reason it out. And so you have a second's thought and it contains 2.5 hours of images. But yeah, it won the Palme d'Or. It was, you know, my screening, which is, again, almost impossible to consider today. My screening at the Angelica on Houston Street in Manhattan was sold out.
Yeah.
It was a packed house. Everybody saw this thing. Everybody had an opinion. Everybody was freaked out by the dinosaurs. Like it was an event. It was a true like American screen event that I believe that excitement kind of traveled the globe as well. I know it was a big deal in France, obviously. And I just think there's something universal about a really ace depiction of childhood. It's why Spirit of the Beehive is still such a treasured film to this day. And E.T., frankly.
Yeah.
You know, and then he immediately, after having been this reclusive figure directing theater in strange corners of the world, adapting Ugetsu for the stage and all this stuff that we didn't know about, you know, in our American, you know, lives, because unless you're a true art enthusiast who understands that, you know, basically unless you're Richard Brody, you had no idea what Terrence Malick was up to.
Shout out to Richard Brody for cataloging it in detail. Big shout out to one of the great critics all time.
Always shout out Richard Brody. Love Richard, a friend and somebody I look up to even now. I just love Richard so much. But he, you know, he vanishes between 78 and 98 as far as being a film culture figure. Comes out with Thin Red Line, which is fully beloved. Everybody views it as the alternative to Saving Private Ryan. Then New World, not as big, and then Tree of Life, somehow bigger than both of them. And then he decides, he's like, oh, you know what? I do like making movies. I'll just keep going. And everybody was like, no, we're good. I couldn't believe that when that started. I was like, what do you mean you're good? You just talked about how he was reclusive. You talked about how you needed more of his movies. Here they are.
He listened to you. You asked.
Yes,
and he
for
did
Christ's
it.
Sake. Yeah, you guys all love it when Tarantino listens to your criticism. Like, why, you know, why? that really took me fully by surprise when I was like, you know, and obviously I wasn't, but it felt as though I was the only person who really kept looking at To the Wonder and finding new ways in, and, you know, was a little more baffled by my initial viewing of Song to Song. And I kind of get it more now. And a lot of that was reading Keith Ulick, who really loved it. And, you know, he kind of broke it open for me a little bit. But Knight of Cups was the one that really felt like mine.
Yeah.
And I watched all three of them in a row to prepare for this. And it still strikes me as the one that I think is the most perfect as far as the reiteration of theme and the sort of closed loop nature of what he's achieving, and you know the way in which what he's trying to say, it's exactly what you know how you put it, which is it's a film about being alienated in the most intimate places in your life where you need to feel the most accepted, and ultimately being inarticulate when it comes to saving that thing. And he just does it over and over again, and each one of those things takes this merry-go-round ride to the extremes of the human experience, bringing somebody else along, only to realize that there really isn't a place for them there, and they don't love your version of life, and you are incapable of changing yourself enough to accommodate this other person. And he keeps going for wilder and wilder people, you know, where he's got buttoned down Kate Winslet and he's got married Natalie Portman, and obviously those were not going to work. But then it's Teresa Palmer, who he meets at a striptease joint. And it's Imogen Poots, who he just meets.
Can I also just say, as an Australian, Teresa Palmer as a wacky hippy-dippy stripper, I'm like, casting chef's kiss. I'm like, yeah, yes. She is a wacky hippy-dippy weird chick. And I love that she's just got her Australian accent. She's like, she's clearly one of the failed dreamers that went out there and did that and is now living, has now been consumed by this kind of like, weird cultish LA thing. I love that little dalliance, because you're just like, especially when you see the sequence of someone's relationships, like if you have close friends or if you know family members that you love and trust, it's like sometimes like if they remind you of a person that you're with, they're like, what were you thinking? And we are doing that. We're like, what were you thinking? Like, Kate, yeah, we see it. It's too late. She's the totally age appropriate one. It's like, oh, then Natalie Portman. Oh, it's the one that can't work, but it's the one that probably should have. And then it's like all these other things. But I want to tag on something you said, which is so brilliant, is like, if your entire life is learning to be consumable like a hotel bottle of like whiskey, in these very artificial, fake, completely contrived situations where everyone's conflating their value, everyone's saying we're having the best time when it's all sort of like doesn't feel quite real, then how do you dissociate that like completely cut off from feeling an artifice from your real life? And it just feels like that entanglement is the whole story. It's like, watch this guy who goes to all these shitty parties, has all these shitty meetings, leverages all of his shitty failures and lack of stuff. Of course, that's going to translate to your life. And obviously, Malick is not like writing it down for anyone. It's like he's an impression of that. Yes. And to his point, it's like, isn't this his greatest fear? Isn't his greatest fear being this guy?
Yeah. That nothing that you actually feel passionate about is what they remember you for, or indeed what you project onto the world. It's not that you're a screenwriter making great art or whatever. It's that you're a fucking back end points obsessed washout, you know, orgy junkie, you know, that you're, you know, like that's that you're defined by your appetites on the street, that you're, you know, what he fears is being the Bradley Cooper, John Peters from Licorice Pizza. And, you know, it, like to be that guy.
Streisand.
I'm going to fucking kill you. Do you know that? I'm going to kill your brother.
One of the great performances.
Him walking up the hill is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's just so cocked with anger. Oh, fuck.
Oh, Paul Thomas, you could just tell if you're Paul Thomas Anderson, you're like, he's fucked.
I have hit the jackpot. That is the best.
This guy is really like, he's really feeling like, obviously he's made A Star Is Born the year before, which I actually think is a terrific performance from him, like top to bottom. And then he comes in there just wanting to go crazy. He wants to get back to like the, I don't want to think too much about this. That was such an involving performance. I want to come on him one day and wear a dumb wig and stupid clothes and just play.
Him, when they walk back, the women walk behind Alana Haim and he chases them like fucking, like he's like Pepe Le Pew. It's amazing. Fuck. But I digress. But that's, yeah, it's what if the emptiness is what they remember and not the poetry? You know what I mean? That's a thing. You know, I don't want to speak for you, but I fear that for sure. You know,
oh, like, my God. Yeah, that's why I do podcasts first.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not trying to be that great. Even we mentioned Richard Brody, like I know that there are people that exist in the world like Richard Brody, like Manola Dargis, like my dear friend Katie Walsh, like people like Walter Chaw, that are the day and day critics. And then up
Stephanie
the back,
Stephanie
Zarek's great. Yeah, Bilger. It's like, I know that those people exist and I'm friendly with them and I'm inspired by them. And some of them I can, very lucky, can call my friends. I'm in the back because that's where I need to be to do what I do. Because that's all I can do is throw it, it. I know the instrument that I play is not that same instrument. And I can't, and I'm like, right. It's maybe in the same orchestra, but it's just not the same instrument.
That's a very good way to put it is, you know, you see that stuff and you're like, okay, yeah. First chair violin there, you know, you're the one.
Manola. That's what I think of Manola. I'm like, there's first chair violin. There you go. Sure. There it is.
The Itzhak Perlman of the particular orchestra there, you know, you just, there are times you're reading a paragraph from some of the people, you know, that you mentioned and, you sort of understand more about what the thing can do. You know, you hear the way that, you know, the tone and tenor of a single note held on a string. It's just like, yeah, no, that's how this is done. And they've been doing it since before I was, you know, through puberty, and they understand this stuff, you know?
Yeah. And but, so in that instance, you're just like, yeah, I don't know whether it's like a weird, like, working class thing background of mine of like, I'm cool being the very good cabinet maker in the mansion. I don't need to be the architect. I'm the cabinet maker. And they're like, fuck, that cabinet's pretty good.
Yes. That's a great cabinet.
That's a fucking great cabinets in here. Who did the cabinets?
Those are, I'll say first, those are excellent fucking cabinets.
Oh, thank you.
Big fan.
Thank you.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's, and this is something that I've never, you know, I'm like trying to work this stuff out just like through fucking therapy and everything. It's just like, what do you do when you're like kind of sort of a public figure and so much of what you experience and go through, and you understand this better than I do because you're on the air, you know, so much of your life, you know, you use this instrument to express yourself. And how much of it is, are you really working through it? You say things, and I do this all the time. You'll say something or write something and you realize that your brain did the math without you realizing it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're like, oh, I understand this thing about myself now, but you haven't taken the time then to go through and think about it and what it means that you understand it and didn't know that you understood it.
I've had to go back and listen to things I said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because, like, sometimes you get the feedback, and this is not a pat on the back thing, but it's like sometimes someone asked me, and this is like a personal thing about like Australia. It's like, what is, like, they were asking about, it was on a great show, Screen Drafts. I was with Elric Kane. I was with another Australian great film critic, Alexi Toliopoulos, and Clay Keller, the fun show. And he asked a context question about Australian history and maybe like why genre did this and why we were so obsessed with this. And all I remembered before a stream of consciousness, that was probably the most prophetic thing I'd said on a podcast to date. I just went, oh, okay. And then I started. And then at the end of it, Clay and Elric were like, wow. And Lex goes, right on. And Clay was like, that's why we do what we do with Screen Drafts is so that experts can come on and actually give us those moments. And at the end of it, I was like, I have no memory of what I said.
I don't know what the fuck I said.
I disconnected any conscious to subconscious connection and I just turned the power on and it just went boom. And there's been times like that on this show where that's all I'm hoping. And I can't ever manufacture it. It just sometimes
happens.
It happens. And so, yeah, I totally understand what you mean. It's like sometimes you just like all you're trying to do is close the distance between the craft and that reservoir of stuff. And yeah, it's really hard for me in my spot. It's like, and then sometimes it randomly happens. It happened the other day. I was talking about The Martian, you know, with Ethan Warren. And hopefully you guys will enjoy that episode. I'll let you guys listen to it. But there was a moment where Ethan's like, why do you think people like relate to this movie so much? And I just went, buh. And then at the end of it, he's like, that was amazing. Where did that come from? I'm like, I don't know. It's just in there. Know. I have it no was, idea. Yeah.
Rattling around. Well, because like The Martian, we are all alone and vessels and we need to entertain ourselves. But, you know, to tie that into Knight of Cups even further, it's the reason Christian Bale doesn't speak in this movie.
Yes.
He has maybe three on-screen lines of dialogue and they're mostly him saying his own name because that is all he offers in those moments. It has nothing to do with his art or frankly, even his influence in relationships, which we have to guess at every time one of them fails. And we really only know that it fails from either the reactions of the women in the scenes or from the fact that a new woman is currently with him on screen.
Yes.
It is about being a passenger, a mute passenger to your own existence.
Yeah.
And how easily that happens. And, you know, this guy has... You know, it's, you know, obviously, like, you know, the little apartment he's in could be bigger, could be a mansion, et cetera. And so there's still, you know, supposedly room for him to continue to grow, which is what the agent characters who are giving great performances have to tell him, that he's not yet Antonio Banderas living the complete freaky high life, but he's on his way there. And the whole way through, the voice that's in his head is his dad's. And he can't get the sort of, you know, he can't get the poet, the actor out of his head. Somebody saying, you were going to be somebody and now you're this womanizing asshole. He even uses the word womanizer, which I was shocked to hear this time because I hadn't heard it in the previous viewings.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's the fear of emptiness. And yeah, my God, I mean, you know, you and I have both felt completely outside at industry parties and, you know, the Fox Searchlight Christmas party and all this other bullshit. You know?
There's a couple of in Australia, the biggest parties that have the most sort of industry things are at a different film festivals because you get you get a blend of international and local guests. And there's been... so many of those that I've gone to where I'm like, these should be my people.
Right. Yeah. Right.
But I'm like, I'm going to the pub, you know, I want to talk to a tradie. I want to talk to someone who is a human being. Because what's happening in here, it doesn't feel human to me. I'm not saying I've been to some crazy party like where there was like debauchery. No. I mean, there probably was much debauchery, but it's just like they're looking at this thing with a total lens of currency and influence and metricated performance, like in terms of like monetary, the value you bring people, that I'm like, oh no, that's not why. That's not why I'm here.
And the kind of equally jarring, bordering on worrisome way in which people who, you know, do what we do more or less for a living, who are willing to completely be subsumed by the atmosphere in order to better fit in with the people who think like that. And it's like, why are you playing their game? You don't do their job. This is a studio. You're not doing PR for a studio. Why on earth are you behaving as though it's some crazy boon to be here? There's free champagne everywhere. Yeah. They want to buy your vote. You're just going to give it to them? Like, I don't know. Yeah, like I got all kinds of looks at these things for being louder than everybody else. And it's like, I got bad news for you. This doesn't get any quieter. Like the more free champagne.
When you say things, I'm like, oh, I've said that to myself. I'm like, if you think I'm going to get any quieter tonight, you are wrong.
Perfect.
If I find my friends here and we can have a couple of drinky poos, that's going to be It's going to be me having a good time no matter what's going on with you idiots, because I'm not here to impress you. I'm me. It's just who I am. There's no pressing flesh or kissing babies with me. I'm like, look, this is what I do. My corridor that I operate within is small and I'm happy with it. I'm fine.
Yes, because they can't ultimately take away what you're good at. You know, the audience you reach might shrink, and the, you know, number of people who tolerate it or whatever might also shrink. But it's just like, yeah, I don't know, because the people who get what you do are always going to be there.
Yeah.
Because even if you space it out or you do it less frequently, it's still the only thing that you do that no one else can do. Everybody can review a fucking movie, but you can't all do it the same way.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I have this very kind of like Irish conception of what the purpose of a writer's life is. And it's, you think about fucking O'Casey and Yeats and everything, and how much of their life was actually taking part in the stuff of life, and, you know, going to bars and being on picket lines and pissing people off with Playboy or the Western World, and then sitting down and taking yourself seriously enough to produce that work in quiet by yourself and take yourself seriously. And all the times that you don't take yourself seriously when you're down at the pub, like,
yeah,
that's, you know, that's sort of always been built into my understanding of this stuff. Or, you know, the Americans, it's David Goodis and Dashiell Hammett and, you know, fucking guys who lived very hard, but were able to produce a line of dialogue that no one else on earth could possibly have put together.
Yeah.
And it's like, the joy of chasing that is part of being alive. And of course, the beauty of Knight of Cups is it's about somebody doing that. And while we never see what he's capable of doing, Malick is consistently, both with camera and with typewriter, producing completely unreproducible things every couple of seconds. You're like, how did you put that together? And why does this fit together so fucking perfectly? Where To the Wonder and Song to Song have longueurs that feel like perhaps he's just sort of trying things out to see if they work. Knight of Cups works every second.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
It's uninterrupted. Yeah, I think Song to Song, if I look at To the Wonder, I think it's a very accomplished film. It's just the harmony of all the elements don't quite resonate. Cool. And with Song to Song, it is like one of those albums where there's like six tracks that are absolutely amazing, and then like five tracks that you're like, what is this shit?
Yes.
It's like someone picked the wrong songs for a greatest hits or something, because it's like,
yes.
And that's what I felt with Song to Song. I was like, I didn't like it, like as a whole cohesive thing, but I think that that's something that I've approached in like obsessively analyzing things. I'm like, I want to feel something. I want to feel it as hard as I can possibly feel it. And the movies that are miraculous to me that make me feel it consistently and hard for the entire enterprise. Whereas if you, even a movie that may be bad that has these spikes like Song to Song, I'm like, yeah, that's I'm okay with that, because you made me feel something that usually most medium movies don't even touch. They don't get to that rarefied air. Whereas Knight of Cups is this languid poem, and I think the artifice of the construction of this whole kind of telling your fortune, the tarot and telling your fortune and chapters and stuff like that, I think that that is, as much as anything, these just kind of like punctuation, you know. It's I don't think he's taking it as seriously as some people have read it. And I think that he gets to play around with taking more one chapter more seriously associated with what he's trying to portray on the screen more seriously than the next. But also, he's such an organic filmmaker that like he's looking for the tone of the whole thing, and he somehow miraculously maintains it.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's, you know, I think part of it is, the mythic framework helps him, because it's very clear that he buys into that as much as is helpful for organizing his thoughts, which does help. I think the problem with To the Wonder is it's too personal because it's very obviously based on past relationships. And I think the problem with Song to Song is it is too impersonal because he doesn't know the first fucking thing about the music business. And Knight of Cups is right in that sweet spot where it is both extremely personal, but also because he's aware that the things that he is showing us are not actually his described experience, he can mold this version of himself.
Yes.
And it, you know, his adventures, and he's got great, you know, thematic clusters in which to place this stuff. And I think he's got just the right distance to make that work. And, you know, he chose the perfect, as he always does, the perfect soundtrack to go with it, where it sort of goes between very contemporary music, which of course it needs to be to place you in the 21st century, to Wojciech Kilar's piece Exodus, which, you know, some people will remember as the trailer music for Schindler's List, which is a, you know, it's kind of a bold choice there. But it works magnificently. To me, it now belongs to Knight of Cups. I can't hear it in anything else, and nobody else should try to put it in anything.
And of course people do, because they're all trying they're trying to crimp from him. It's like, this is what's so fun about this project, is like the films that I see that were definitely critical and or commercial failures and stuff that has started to be rediscovered or re-looked at, and especially from great filmmakers like Terrence Malick, this elusive guy whose resume, as you talked about and articulated earlier, was like Badlands, Days of Heaven, 5-year gap, 20-year gap to Thin Red Line, then like 7-year gap to The New World, which is a movie that has been utterly reclaimed. I mean, just completely, you know, Criterion Collection and reappraised, and then Tree of Life 2011. So he's, you know, all of those movies are such titanic influence. But I think that this one, you would have this in your environment, I would have it in mine. Every person that you see in our industries or other industries that you work in, sometimes it's like the person who you're like, oh, that person's really good at this game. Like, you play the game as well as you can play it. And as you get older, you play the game very accomplishedly because you're like, you've seen lots of different iterations of the game. But then there's someone who like is natural, and you're like, you can imagine that Terrence Malick has like been waiting in an agency office and heard the next guy who's taken points and this sort of stuff and just gone like, that could never be me. And he's like, and then he goes home and writes it down. And it's like, that's him. That guy cares about this shit. He's like letting these agents talk, where I'm like, this doesn't interest me.
And it's amazing how much he packs into that one interaction in the movie, where you suddenly understand so much about Terrence Malick from that minute and change of screen time, where they're talking about like, oh, it's a comedy scene now and we're gonna do all this, and it's just like, I'm not fucking doing that. I don't have any clue how to do that, and I have no interest. I am the James Joyce of the cinema. I'm not about to fucking, you know, like, I cannot break this down to component parts that you can then workshop. This is not a car, it is a journey. You know, it's where the car goes. And that's he so obviously doesn't understand all that stuff, but he is also, we must say, one of the great observers and notators of life, because there is so many, I mean, you know, each of these new films is full of 100,000 relatable moments.
Yes.
And some of them resonate more than others, obviously, but these are all things that he quite obviously saw firsthand, or was able to recognize the truth and reality of those moments in order to include them into what were very clearly extremely personal works that he churned out as quickly as he's ever done anything. And it's like, because he's trying to capture something ephemeral about the modern world, and the modern world is going to change as he's doing it. Yeah. And so, you know, I remember when To the Wonder came out, the sort of like agog reaction of some of the people who were the first run critics who reviewed it, where they're like, Terrence Malick filming a Sonic drive-in, like what to make of this. You know, because it was not anything we were used to seeing. You know, we were used to historical pastorals from him, and he was really good at making them. You know, that brilliant opening 5 minutes of Thin Red Line, that's what we associate Terrence Malick with. Or the, you know, the fire at the end of Days of Heaven. It's, you know, these kinds of movies whose feet never touch the ground. And then suddenly they had to, because they had to take in modern America, even if it was nevertheless a fairly rarefied version of it, where it's musicians in Austin and screenwriters in LA and some kind of fairly wealthy land surveyor into the wonder. And I find it also very telling that after having spent, you know, a collective 5 to 6 years on this great modernist project, he then immediately retreated once more to the historic.
Yeah.
Because he seemed to fare better and find himself there. And of course, it got better reviews than anything since Tree of Life.
Yeah.
I think people give you a reprieve when it's when you're wearing suspenders in a way that they don't when you're wearing a Brooks Brothers suit.
Yeah,
it's and it's
also because that's the great thing is, like, I think people give you permission. I'm gonna go on a freaking wild tangent here. It is
please do.
The Joe Lynch, a very fun American film horror filmmaker and podcaster, sure. Terrific guy. Love Joe and friend. Joe was like, he was talking on our show with Katie Walsh and I, Miami Nice. He's like, I just wish they called it Florida Cops, because it just the fact that it was called Miami Vice made it so hard for people to enter and just appreciate it. And I had the absolutely oppositional perspective. I'm like, no, it's Michael Mann. It's called Miami Vice. Deal with it. Like,
yes.
Deal with it. Miami Vice doesn't mean the 80s. Michael Mann. No. Wrote it in visuals and the palette. He created the palette that then became the icon, and it's him and this fantastic international film critic Jean-Baptiste Theray, who's an author who's written a contemporary retrospective on Michael Mann. I'm a huge admirer of him, and he's a friend. And he just goes, Blake, style's everything. Style is content. I don't care about the and he's like, well, if I was going to show my film students at the old university in Paris that I would lecture at different films to illustrate different times, I would show them for the 80s, I would show them Thief, and for the 90s, I'd show them Heat, and for the early 2000s, I'd show them Miami Vice, because Michael Mann captures the reality. And I think also people are like, oh, that's not what my life's like. And I think if you go in and go, that's not what my life's like, or it's not what it feels like, you're missing the entry place. You're in a place of lacking empathy right from the beginning. Your hackles are up with like, I don't want this pastoral life. What you have to do is just surrender. And maybe me, and definitely you too, is like, I look at that and I'm like, he is giving me a portal into what I feel like in certain situations in my life, of like feeling alien in a space where like a whole bunch of people are like, how does this place work? Who the hell are these people? How do these people make this much money? It's like, you do these things. He just dragged me in. And it does feel like that early there's more money in Hollywood. There's bigger, older stars. There's more traditional kind of pathways. It's like all that stuff that he doesn't even mention. It's all there in the tapestry. And much like it is in Song to Song, they're like little beautiful, like decade, like snapshots of like the 2010s, of like what life is like there. And it then tips into our modern decade, and like now a Hollywood party is completely different. It's TikTok influencers, and it's either completely the oldest people in the world who have the most money you've ever even heard of, like Spielberg and Scorsese at one end, and then you've got like a TikTok influencer at the other end. It's like it's a weird time. Like, this is kind of like the last gasp of classic Hollywood stuff, and even it's probably a little bit delayed or detached and unrealistic from the 2015 of it all. It's probably just in that cusp of like 2012, you know, still a huge period for movies, still a huge period for movie stars, still a huge period for money making in Hollywood in a traditional sense, and the town would be unrecognizable. So in fact, that's part of the beautiful lesson that we learn in the age, is like, no, he was spot on with what that world was at that time. He was spot on. And he obviously takes years to make his movies. So it was like probably 2013 where he probably started, but it's like, that's the time that he was capturing and rendering. And that's the time that we can like look back and go, yeah, he nailed it. He nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. And, you know, to piggyback on what you're saying about, you know, style and whatever, I always go back to, you know, both a very formative film and a very formative ideology for me was Lindsay Anderson's If and the Free Cinema Manifesto.
Yeah.
And it's, no film can be too personal, what is it? Size doesn't matter. Perfection is not an aim. Image speaks, sound comments, and an attitude means a style, and a style implies an attitude. And it's like, yeah, the way that you show the world, you know, Lindsay Anderson at his best in If and Oh Lucky Man,
yeah,
that tells you everything you need to know about that person. You know exactly who he is, you know exactly what he's been through, and you know exactly how he feels about the world and his place in it. And the job of the director is to transmit all that stuff, to place you in a world and a space nobody else can put you in. And God knows that that's Terrence Malick all over. It's, you know, his movies are not political in the agitprop way of somebody like Costa Gavras, but they are political in that you learn over the course of his career what he thinks about sharecropping and the Second World War and, yeah, you know, and the early colonizing experiment of what becomes the United States. It's, you know, it's all in there. And what he seeks throughout it is the poetic in the chaotic. And even that, of course, implies an attitude. It implies what he, you know, what he searches for, and indeed what he believes should be the search from all people. It's in Tree of Life. It's spelled out, this dichotomy, the way of nature and the way of grace. And he believes that a person's great aim should be to locate and celebrate and become of the graceful way that, yeah, only people can be at their most empathetic and delicate. And, you know, you think about the touch of the mother in that film and all of those beautiful things that he has dictated, you know, the escaping away onto the Polynesian island in Thin Red Line, where this white man has no place, nor should he. But it's this search for some commonality between all people. Very, very crucially, none of that is in Knight of Cups, because when your entire life is this debauched celebration of the emptiness of the self, then how do you even know what grace looks like then, when you have been through the ringer in this way and you've completely dedicated yourself to escaping the poetic part of you that brought you to the place that you are? Unless, for all we know, this guy has written, you know, fucking Liar Liar or something, you know, came of age in the 90s writing fucking Flubber or Jack or what, you know. Love. It's entirely possible that this person has been, you know, a whore his entire life. And you know, what then when you have not made any room for yourself, for these things to grow and for your search for them to become a part of the way that you view the world and, you know, to seek them out at long last. I mean, you know, not for nothing does our character wander through the desert, and we check in crying in the desert, looking for himself, trying to discover the part of him that's missing, that is making all of these relationships go bad. Yeah, it's every little thing about it. It keeps, you pull one thread and it goes right back into the loop until the button is sewn. It is a perfect piece of cinema.
And it's so funny. The final thing I'll say before we wrap up is just like the relationships being so lost that you don't even know what you want should be the message that you get, because he has every one of these great people. Mm-hmm. None of them feel completely crazy or toxic. They kind of feel strange or intense or whatever, but none of them feel completely, you know, toxic kind of women. And it's just him going to these like different archetypes and failing miserably every time. And you're like, you don't know what you want. You don't have a type. You're looking for an elevated experience and you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm,
And it's only when they realize that he's trying to get them to help him discover himself that they're all like, no, this is ending.
Right.
I'm not here to help you find yourself.
Right. Yeah. I am not the tool of your self-discovery. I am a person. It's, you know,
yes.
one of the moments that always kind of like makes me, it's like, it's a little cringe, but it's also, it's true, is when,
and you know what? True stuff is cringe.
Yeah. The facts. This is, she points at him in the parking lot and says, "I think you're weak." And it's clearly the middle of an improvisation. And that's the part of it, because so much of To the Wonder and Knight of Cups, I'm sorry, To the Wonder and Song to Song built from improv that didn't necessarily go the place that Malick thought it was going to go, because there's a self-consciousness about those actors who were not expecting, I think, to do as much improv as they wound up doing. Because understandably, watching Tree of Life and Thin Red Line and New World, you're like, oh, there must be a script. And then to get there and realize that he needs you to stand with purpose and embrace with purpose and move through the world like somebody else and constantly expressing yourself through movement, that's almost like asking somebody to dance their way through an entire film. And yeah, that must have been exhausting, especially for somebody like Ben Affleck at that time in his life.
Yeah.
You know, this is just pre-Phoenix tattoo, but he's still extremely, you know, he's
clearly... Led him straight to the Phoenix.
Yes.
To the Wanda.
Yes, very much. And it's, yeah, because, you know, I think Malick said at the time that he had like a Clark Gable quality to him, and he did. And I think part of that was he was not somebody who could shut off the actor brain. He was not somebody who could just stand there with purpose. I mean, he does manage a very good performance in that movie, I should say. But you can see on his face and in his posture every way in which he's uncomfortable. Christian Bale by then was used to it, and he knew exactly what he was doing. And I think every actress basically knew precisely how to get into that thing, because so much more is asked of actresses, you know, to in Hollywood than we ask of actors, where you don't have to be this immediate archetype where you know exactly who you are. And you're like, oh, you're the girl next door, or you're the party girl, or you're the studious one, or you're the, you know, the frigid ex-wife or whatever the thing is. And I think that for that reason, our actresses are so much more natural when you ask them really quickly to jump into an improvised scene and actually make something out of that, make meaning from that. You know, you think it would, to go back to Teresa Palmer in Vegas, there isn't a dishonest second of that. I know people like that, and I know exactly why she's doing everything that she's doing. And I was just like, yeah, you're following.
And if
her-
you want to meet them, there's a whole bunch of them on the Gold Coast. Next to Byron Bay, there's like there's a cafe of those women talking right now in Byron Bay. We have to drive about 8 hours from my house, but when we get there, they'll still be there doing yoga next to the beach. Like, they will be there.
There you go. And you know what? I bet also I would follow one of them into the desert like Bale does. I want to briefly as well.
What happened to Scout? I get a call from your dad. What happened to Scout? He followed this hippy-dippy Teresa Palmer looking chick into the desert.
Into the dead, like a mirage. I was very confused at first because this movie, one of the only ones, has both Teresa Palmer and Isabel Lucas, who to me were the same person for a very long time. but they're both wonderful for different reasons. I can tell them apart now.
Yes.
And I love them both. I love them both so much. Teresa Palmer's so good in Berlin Syndrome by
Berlin
Kate
Syndrome
Shortland.
Is a good movie. Yes. Kate Shortland, great filmmaker.
Yeah, great filmmaker. But we go.
Look, I think we've heaped love on this thing. Go see Knight of Cups. It's got a harmony to it. Even if you're just not, I sort of almost challenge you to like be doing something else. Mm-hmm. If you haven't revisited in a while, and just see how quickly it gets you and just gets its hooks in you. An amazing
character of a lullaby or a fable. It just, oh God, it's so beautiful.
Beautiful. Can't tell it any better than that. Scout DeFoy, you're an absolute legend. I'll share with everyone where people can find you. This has been an absolute treat. And he's asked the biggest question of the Decade Project so far. Who is doing Magic Mike XXL? A question that will be unanswered. But if I don't get people bashing down the door, it might just have to be bros, some shirtless bros together to...
Listen, don't threaten me with a good time. I'll be here tomorrow to do this. I know.
We don't have to revisit it. We know it. It's all up here.
All up here, baby. We live that movie.
Oh God.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at USAHockeyNTDP.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.